Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Bray. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that have stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always, that's everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away in the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, development stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love, just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. Trying really hard not to do snark. I'm trying really hard not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how difficult it is to get a film made. Each episode I cover two films and, well, that's all the preamble we need, really. Both of this week's films are going back to the 1980s. And let's do a bit of James Bond. I'm going to play you a clip from a trailer first. We'll come into the story. The other side of this.
Until recently, all microchips were susceptible to damage from the intense magnetic pulse of a nuclear explosion.
They're identical.
Zorin Industries. What about Zorin himself?
Max Zorin, impossible. He's a leading French industrialist. A staunch anti-communist with influential friends in the government.
Main strikes in 3 days. Any delays, I hold you responsible.
You lost, 007.
My department know I'm here. When I don't report, they'll retaliate.
They'll more likely try to cover up your embarrassing incompetence.
Your helicopter leaves in 20 minutes.
She must take a lot of vitamins.
That then was a clip from the 1985 James Bond adventure A View to a Kill, directed by John Glenn. Screenplay credited to Richard Mayborn and Michael G. Wilson, based on James Bond, of course, by Ian Fleming, and starring Roger Moore, Tanya Roberts, Grace Jones, Patrick McNee, Christopher Walken, and yes, Dolph Lundgren as well. So the James Bond saga, in the early 1980s, I mean, it was defined for a little while by the battle between two competing movies, the official 1983 James Bond film, Octopussy, the unofficial 1983 James Bond film, Never Say Never Again, Roger Moore versus Sean Connery at the box office. Neither of them the best entries in the James Bond saga. And once the dust had settled on all of that, well, the plan was for the official James Bond films, produced, of course, by Albert R. Broccoli, to keep going. At this stage in the land of 007, they were coming at some pace as well. Since 1977's brilliant The Spy Who Loved Me, James Bond movies had been arriving in cinemas every 2 years, and true to form, at the end of 1983's Octopussy came the tease that James Bond would return in the film From a View to a Kill. Now, producer Albert R. Broccoli had already signalled he had no inclination to wait around, that he was recruiting people very, very quickly, even while Octopussy was in post-production. It was pretty certain that Richard Mayborn and Michael G. Wilson would be penning the script for From a View to a Kill. It came, the actual Ian Fleming story came from a short story collection called For Your Eyes Only, and it gave enough of a nucleus for them really to, well, basically developed pretty much their own thing, just taking that original Fleming, just to give them some degree of foundation for him. I mean, contemplating the source material for the film, and I'm going to AJ Chowdhury and Matthew Field's excellent book, Some Kind of Hero, here. Michael G. Wilson was quoted as saying, "For all practical purposes, we've been out of material for the past five films in terms of original Ian Fleming material." He says, "We bring in the occasional Fleming elements from the books, which haven't been used in the films, but that's not much help when you get down to basic plotting." And so when they started knocking their heads together to come up with the ideas for the film, they went back to the Fleming text, but also they were like, what haven't we used before? What ideas had we tried to put into James Bond movies before that hadn't gone in? So there was an Eiffel Tower stunt, for instance, that had originally been conceived for the Roger Moore starring Moonraker, which I've covered before on this podcast. There'd been a discarded plot about Halley's Comet at one stage that was going to be in this particular movie. In the end, they settled on Silicon Valley, and to go a little bit high tech, which gives me a perfect opportunity to stop and say that I got the ZX Spectrum computer game of A View to a Kill for Christmas one year, and it is one of the most crushing disappointments of all of my Christmases. Absolutely terrible game, an infamously terrible and incomplete game. To everybody who worked on that, thank you, you made me cry. Now, by the time script work was underway, John Glenn was already aboard as director of From a View to a Kill. Now, Octopussy had been his second James Bond film. He'd made his 007 debut in 1981's For Your Eyes Only. And it was during the making of Octopussy that Albert R. Broccoli just asked him if he would be interested to make the next one, and he quickly agreed to do so. At the moment, we're in a James Bond era where the search for a new director tends to be quite prolonged. Back then, pretty much done deal. Nice and straightforward. John Glenn back behind the camera. Also due to star was Roger Moore as 007. But this was a point where pretty much everyone knew going into it this was likely to be his final 007 movie. Now, Roger Moore wrote about this in his memoir, My Word Is My Bond. And he talked about, at 57, I felt a little long in the tooth, a bit like Gary Cooper in the film Love in the Afternoon. But he talked about how Broccoli called him up to ask him if he'd have a go at going at playing Bond again. And Moore just reasoned. He said, "I was pretty fit, still able to remember lines." He said, a rather nice deal was agreed with my agent. And once again, I slipped into the tuxedo. Admittedly, it had been a bit let out since my first film to play Jimmy Bond one last time. He pretty much knew it would be the final time. And in fact, the stunt doubles would have their work cut out, just doubling up for key action sequences on the film that eventually became known as A View to a Kill. Now, an old friend of Roger Moore's was Patrick McNee, and he got in touch with the actor and said that he'd heard there might be a part in this particular James Bond movie that might be suitable for him. By this stage, unbeknownst to McNee, this had already been discussed, and Roger Moore confirmed to his friend that Albert R. Broccoli was already talking about getting in touch with him for a role, which he duly did. I'll come back to the casting in a minute, though, because there was a huge logistical problem that came weeks before production got underway on A View to a Kill, that the pre-production work on a James Bond film is by necessity extensive, planning shoots around the world, planning the elaborate pre-credits stunt, which was done this time in the Swiss Alps, but also just production design, getting everything, getting all the mechanics of everything in place. But thankfully for James Bond films, they'd always had their base. They'd had the 007 stage at Pinewood Studios. Now, the big logistical problem that hit A View to a Kill came during filming on a different movie, the Ridley Scott-directed film Legend. And things weren't going quite to plan there because that happened to be shooting at Pinewood. And it was during a lunch break during the filming of Legend that there had been an explosion taking place on the 007 stage, which led to pretty much the entire thing burning down. Now, the plan had been to house a mine sequence there, and it was left to production designer Peter Lamont to, back at pretty much square one, to work out how long it would take to get things back up and running. In fact, the story is picked up by Albert R. Broccoli in his own autobiography, where he said on June the 27th, 1984, just as we were preparing to shoot A View to a Kill, a devastating fire destroyed the 007 set at Pinewood Studios. He wrote that it took barely minutes to reduce the largest soundstage in the world to a heap of blackened, twisted metal. And so, as Broccoli wrote again, he said the immediate dilemma here was whether to write the whole thing off and film interiors on another set or rebuild the stage at an estimated cost of £1 million. And the studio pretty much held its breath at that point. By this stage, Pinewood had been housing James Bond films for over two decades, and there were rumours going round that Broccoli may just switch to Hollywood, that he would go somewhere else. And so he met Cyril Howard in the midst of the rubble of the 007 stage at Pinewood. Now, Cyril Howard was the managing director of Pinewood Studios, and also Michael Brown was an architect with the original buildings, and so there was a decision to be made. There wasn't much, as Broccoli noted, left to see except the charred remains of the sign saying 007 stage. And so the idea was, make the call there. Are we going to Hollywood or are we rebuilding it? And Broccoli just felt the idea of being of a Bond film other than house somewhere other than Pinewood just didn't feel right. And he said, in a sense, it had been my home too. And he said, okay, let's build it again. And so they had less than 5 months ahead of schedule to rebuild that stage for the sequences they needed for A View to a Kill. For Peter Lamont, he had 16 weeks to be able to get it just back up and running so they could start building the sets and put it in there. And it was all duly completed. Now, Roger Moore was in the lead role, of course, but in terms of the villain, well, that part ultimately, Max Zorin, went to Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken, not quite as famous as he is now, but still very, very notable screen presence, even at this point, off the back of a couple of very high-profile roles as well. But he wasn't the first choice to play Max Zorin. They were looking for someone just a little bit offbeat and off the wall. And so two music stars got the first phone calls. One was Sting and the other was David Bowie. Now, Sting met up with John Glenn, but he just simply couldn't fit the film in his schedule. He had too many other commitments. And Bowie would say, many years later, that he was offered A View to a Kill. And he says, I think for an actor, it's probably an interesting thing to do. But Bowie argued, I think for somebody from rock, it's more of a clown performance. And I didn't want to spend 5 months watching my double fall off mountains. And so David Bowie also declined the offer. That hadn't stopped the producers announcing that David Bowie would be appearing in A View to a Kill, and they had to do a bit of a reverse ferret there as well. Meanwhile, Christopher Walken was treading the boards in New York, that he was on stage in a play over in America when the offer came in for him to take on the role of Max Zorin, which he would ultimately agree to. Also sounded out was Priscilla Presley about playing one of the female leads in the film. She was committed to the shooting schedule on the TV show Dallas at that point. And so it was in August of 1984 that the principal photography on A View to a Kill got underway. By this stage, the opening sequence had already been shot, that the second unit had been doing their work there. But Tanya Roberts and Grace Jones signed up as the female leads in the film. And that that gave the tagline for the poster. Has James Bond finally met his match with Roger Moore back to back with Grace Jones on one of the original theatrical posters for the movie? But there was a long way before it got to that release. The first sequences outside of the pre-credits bit were shot at Ascot. There's quite a lot of horse racing in A View to a Kill, if you're familiar with the movie. But also, this inevitably was going around the world. And as John Glenn told 007.com in an interview, he said, with A View to a Kill, we had a wonderful location in San Francisco, for instance. Now, the mayor Feinstein, gave us wonderful cooperation, he'd said. We told her the outline that we wanted to set a light to City Hall, and she didn't raise an eyelid. She asked how much money we were going to spend, and when we said about $5 million, she said, you can do what you like. You can burn down City Hall if you want. Fortunately, she had great faith in their fire chief, who we worked very closely with, reported Glenn, and a sequence involving City Hall in San Francisco was duly committed to film. There's the opening stunt, or certainly the dramatic stunt, in and around the Eiffel Tower in the movie as well. That involved the work of stunt genius B.J. Worth. And it also, I mean, on the last episode of the podcast, I talked about Christopher Nolan choosing to shoot Dunkirk on the French beach in Dunkirk, and the amount of permissions required to be able to shoot that movie. Similar kind of problem, a very protected area of France, the Eiffel Tower, took a lot of permissions to be able to shoot just directly there. But also for Worth, there was the problem of how do you do the fall? How do you do the big stunt in the movie at the Eiffel Tower, which I'm not going to expressly spoil, but I mean, the guts of it were that it was put together involving a diving board being mounted on the tower to allow the stunt performer to get sufficient clearance to be able to get high enough just to basically clear the thing. Now, what they then had to do was shorten the diving board, because otherwise you just look like you've put a swimming diving board on the Eiffel Tower, and you needed to be able to hide it from the camera. So that took a little bit of work as well. The script had called, as Roger Moore wrote, for Grace Jones's character Mayday to leap off the tower, open a parachute and land on a boat on the River Seine. And as Moore noted, however, while the authorities had been given permission for takeoff, we didn't have permission to land. And apparently the river came under the remit of another authority, and only on the day of the shoot was permission to land in the river forthcoming. Moore talked about his co-stars in his book, and I mean, it didn't sound like he'd had the best of times, really. That he talked about how Christopher Walken had a reputation for being difficult, but said, I never found him so. He liked to be prepared, and he liked everyone else to be prepared, so maybe he didn't suffer fools, and they branded him difficult. Moore talked about how Tanya Roberts was cast as Stacey Sutton, and then there was Grace Jones cast as Mayday. And as he wrote, I've always said, if you've got nothing nice to say about someone, then you should say nothing. So I'll say nothing. Those are his exact words. His exact words. He would go on in his book, though, to talk about one thing that drove me mad was that between every take, my leading ladies would both rush over to their handbags and pull out a lipstick and mirror, and time after time they did it, and time after time we had to wait for them. So when they weren't looking, I reached into their bags, pulled out the lipstick and mirrors and hid them. A few minutes later, they returned, reached in and pulled out a lipstick and mirror. Apparently they had half a dozen of each in the bag. But his point there that he explores in the book was they were more worried in his eyes about appearance than performance. Neither of the pair had managed to retort on that, but the reason I bring that story in is just a little sense of tension just between the cast shooting the movie. Now, Grace Jones was dating Dolph Lundgren at the time as well, and so when John Glenn saw Dolph Lundgren, he decided to give him a small part in the film. This would be Dolph Lundgren's big screen acting debut as well, and apparently got on with people, was well liked. They arranged some publicity photos to be taken, and this was the catalyst that led to him making one of the greatest films of the 1980s, Rocky IV. It was because of just that kind of fluke moment almost during the making of A View to a Kill. Also among the credits was Barbara Broccoli, now the overseer of the James Bond franchise with Michael G. Wilson. Now, Broccoli at this stage was amongst the production crew for only the second time. She's one of the assistant directors. One of her jobs was to get Grace Jones to the set on time, which apparently took a little bit of negotiation. And Jones really wasn't winning friends, particularly Roger Moore. I mean, the two of them just weren't getting on. And it got to, I mean, there's no easy way to get through this story, so let's all hold hands and get through it together. Roger Moore confirmed that in a love scene with Grace Jones, he got into bed, slipped between the sheets with her, followed by her, he wrote, and her rather large black dildo. And his note after that was, I'm glad she thought it was funny. I've not seen the outtake of that, so I can't confirm it actually happened. Going back to Cubby, Albert R. Cubby Broccoli, though, he was talking about different problems he was having during the shooting of the movie. If we go back to his book, he talked about how a man called Frank Yablans had been hired as production chief at basically the parent studio of the James Bond films, MGM United Artists. It would be fair to say that Frank Yablans and Albert R. Broccoli would not get on. And I'm going to quote Broccoli's words here, where he talks about how Mr. Yablans regrettably showed little finesse, criticising subordinates in front of others. Broccoli recounted how difficulties arose even before we started shooting A View to a Kill, that Michael G. Wilson had agreed the budget for the picture with David Wardlow. Now, Wardlow at this point was the head of production at United Artists, but then in came Frank Yablans, quote, came in claiming to have no knowledge of this arrangement in spite of the fact that Michael had sent him a detailed breakdown. Broccoli continued. He said, Yablans went further. The budget's too big. No one told me anything about it. I'm cancelling the project. Now, the budget for the film was on the high side, $30 million. But as Broccoli noted, if he thought he had intimidated Michael G. Wilson, he soon learned otherwise, because Michael Wilson called him up and said, Frank, I'm on a private line. This is just between the two of us. Let me lay this out. And Michael G. Wilson took Frank Yablans through the budget line by line, which had been agreed. And Yablans listened and said, OK, I'll tell that to the board of directors. And so when Michael G. Wilson referred to his last sentence, Yablans interrupted saying, no, I didn't say that. I said I tried to sell that to the board of directors. So they're just tensions just surrounding it all, really. And at one point, apparently Frank Yablans, who hasn't counted this, so I should note that as well, allegedly tried to cancel one of the French locations for the film and argue that they don't need to go to France to shoot the Eiffel Tower. Well, the methodology of the James Bond film is you go to generally where you need to go to shoot it. You don't try to fake it unless you absolutely have to. There was towards, I mean, long physical production on James Bond films. A View to a Kill was no different as well. And I mean, the Pinewood was coming back to life, the 007 stage. But what happened was they sort of ran out of sets. They weren't quite ready to film absolutely everything. So they had to have a shutdown over Christmas in 1984, which were they presumably going to do anyway. But it just gave a little bit of extra time to get that 007 stage absolutely right. Filming wrapped up on A View to a Kill in January of 1985. In the middle of January 1985, Roger Moore shot his last work as James Bond. It didn't give it a lot of time to sort the editing out, but this is a very practically driven production anyway. The film was going to be released that summer. What it meant was John Barry had to get his score together, and Duran Duran was brought in to do the title song as well. And as thanks to the mayor of San Francisco for her help in securing the locations they needed for certain moments of A View to a Kill, it was agreed that the world premiere would be held in San Francisco on the 22nd of May 1985. So that's what, around 4 months after filming completed, which is more time than they had on Spectre, as I've covered before on this podcast. Partner Spectre had 3 months from the last shot being called to it being in cinemas. In the case of A View to a Kill, this was in an era where they had to strike physical prints, so it's still roughly the same amount of time. But I mean, an intense race to the finish line, with Peter Davis being the person in charge of the editing of the movie. Sean Connery was interviewed at that San Francisco premiere of A View to a Kill, and he said, I mean, he clearly got the memo of how to promote a film. He stated at that point that Roger Moore was too old for the role of James Bond. Now, Moore had come to this conclusion himself when he realised that the mother of the film's inverted commas Bond girl, Tanya Roberts, was actually younger than he was when he was playing the role of 007. But I mean, the film still went in front of critics. It had its UK premiere, Royal Film premiere, on the 24th of May 1985 in front of Prince Charles and Princess Diana, who come up in the next film story in this particular episode as well, as it would happen. And the response to it was, I mean, it was all right. It was fine. I mean, pretty much every review, it seemed, tended to note that Roger Moore was in his late 50s at the point of making this film. Didn't seem to matter that he'd been in his mid-50s when Octopussy came out. It was in the case of A View to a Kill that this was the time where his age was going to be sharply brought into focus. In fact, Moore would admit many years later that he was far too old to do his final James Bond film. He would talk about how this was the least favourite of the James Bond films that he made. But all that notwithstanding, reviews somewhere in the middle. I mean, there was some good reviews, some middling reviews. There was general feeling this wasn't a flat-out classic. Nonetheless, out it went into cinemas, and I mean, reviewers be damned as always. 10.6 million actually opened with in the US on May the 24th to the 26th, 1985. This was, again, I have to say this quite a lot, the era where big box office opening weekends were not commonplace. It was expected that a film would take months to be able to make its box office returns. That 10.6 million, not bad. I mean, it wasn't in first place. That honour went to Rambo First Blood Part 2 with $20 million. So that was, I mean, a hefty return. But A View to a Kill was going to hang around for a little while. The following week, as Rambo continued to make money, out came the first Fletch movie and knocked A View to a Kill down to third place. Fletch was in second. Rambo was topping the chart. Then The Goonies followed the week after that. I mean, what a summer this was. Still A View to a Kill happily in the top five. It did another week there as films like Daryl and Prince's Honour came about. And then it was Cocoon, Life Force and Return to Oz. What a cheery, upbeat and non-terrifying film Return to Oz is. But in the case of A View to a Kill, I mean, the general feeling was it done all right. I mean, it did $50 million of business in the US. Outside of the US, it did another $100 million. And so, you know, who's keeping score at this point? The James Bond films were making money, critics be damned. I mean, if we put this by the box office returns of the films that came before, it was down on Octopus's number. In fact, it was the lowest grossing of all of the Roger Moore James Bond films since The Man with the Golden Gun. Man with the Golden Gun, 97.6 million. View to a Kill, 152.4. Below The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy. And in fact, when the inevitable reboot came, The Living Daylights would follow and add another 40 million to the box office take with A New James Bond and the novelty factor just included there. A View to a Kill wasn't the most expensive of Roger Moore's James Bond movies either. That honour went to Moonraker with $34 million. It was slightly more expensive to make than Octopussy and For Your Eyes Only. I would suggest that Roger Moore's best James Bond films, The Spy Who Loved Me, I've got a real soft spot for Live and Let Die as well, both of those far more economical productions, appreciating they were made slightly earlier in time, and that also has its impact as well. The time was coming, though, for Roger Moore's future as 007 to be addressed. And in their respective autobiographies, Albert R. Broccoli and Roger Moore have slightly different recollections of how this was. Because Broccoli, in his memoir, would talk about having to tell Roger Moore that his time as 007 was over. Now, Moore countered this. And in his own book, he said, "Cubby and I sat down one day afterwards, reflecting on A View to a Kill success, mutually agreed that it was time for a younger actor to pick up the Walther PPK. He said there was no drama, no tears, aside from my agent. There's certainly no big discussion where Cubby told me that it was all over and I had to accept it. That, however, was not the case, as reported in his autobiography completed by Donald Zeck, his co-author, after Cubby's death. And Roger Moore said he felt very hurt by what Broccoli was saying about how he wasn't letting go of the James Bond role suitably easily. But let go of it, he did. But what that didn't do was slow the James Bond saga down at all. That very soon afterwards, Pierce Brosnan was cast as the new 007. And then, famously, a contractual obligation to the TV show Remington Steele meant that Pierce Brosnan was not going to be James Bond in the movie that became The Living Daylights, that the torch would be passed instead to Timothy Dalton. But in the case of A View to a Kill, it brought to an end one of the, well, in terms of number of films, the longest run of any actor taking on the role of James Bond 007. And I mean, he talked about how in hindsight he probably shouldn't have done A View to a Kill. But I do want to acknowledge that there are quite a lot of people who really go out and fight for the film. I mean, personally, I think it's an upgrade on Octopussy, which I did have a fair amount of problems with, but I said that on the internet once and I got some correspondence in return. A View to a Kill was very much an end of one era kind of James Bond movie anyway, and the Timothy Dalton ones would allow the franchise to be reinvented in a tougher, harder edged kind of way. But again, that's not without problems either. I've covered The Living Daylights and the brilliant License to Kill actually on previous episodes of the Film Stories podcast. It's worth noting though, A View to a Kill played in cinemas for over 30 weeks. As much as it's regarded generally as a minor entry in the James Bond saga, and the only one that involves microchips and horses in the same film, it was successful. You know, it wasn't as successful as the one before, but it was successful. It played in cinemas for a long time. And I mean, as recently as a year or two ago from when this has been recorded, A View to a Kill also got a big screen re-release as well. I will still say though, until I breathe my last breath, that computer game was an absolute abomination. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. I'm in the parish notice section of the podcast. So let me do my parish notices. Firstly, if you like this podcast and don't mind supporting it, there are a trio of really good ways to do so outside of listening to it. I really like the fact you're listening to it. I'm not trivialising the fact you're listening to it. I appreciate the fact you're listening to it. If you want to support it financially, if you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew, put a few coins in the pot there. You get the podcast early, you get it ad free pretty much every week as well. You also find out the gossip of just what's going on behind the scenes at Film Stories. It's really busy at the moment. I'm a very tired and very old and grumpy man. Costing you absolutely nothing is to subscribe to the podcast at your podcast home of choice. I hugely appreciate anyone doing that, of course. It helps with algorithms and weird things that I don't understand, as does the third of the ways, which is to leave ideally a hugely positive review for independents just trying to get noticed when other people are spending lots of money and things like that. Stuff like that that really helps Film Stories cut through, and I really massively appreciate everyone who's gone out to bat for this podcast. Thank you very much. I also print magazines that are made under the Film Stories name. Really proud of these. I'm a huge film magazine nerd. I'm a huge print nerd as well. I'm working at the moment on issue 49 of Film Stories magazine, which I hope to be able to tell you about in the next episode of this podcast. It's 168 pages. I mean, on really nice paper as well. You can find all of my print magazines at store.filmstories.co.uk, including Film Junior, which I'm working on the latest issue of that too. Film Junior is the only film magazine regularly made here in the UK for young film fans and primarily written by them as well. A print film magazine for youngsters. Imagine that. I wish it had existed when I grew up. It exists now, and thank you again to everyone who supports it. store.filmstories.co.uk. That is the parish notices though, and I have waffled on those enough. So I'm going to go back to the 1980s again for a really controversial independent British film that turned out to be a sizable hit, but not without a degree of backlash. Let me play you a clip from the trailer first. I'm going to come to the story the other side of this.
Phil Collins in his motion picture debut as Buster. Keep on running. A small-time crook. Keep on hiding. Oh, yeah. Be your man. With big-time dreams.
What is it? Elizabeth Taylor's jewelry.
It's a Royal Mail train. £1 million.
Telling me he's doing it all for me.
This is a crime against the very structure of our society.
Right. We'll go.
At the poker. Who is that?
Oh, Mexico, you ignorant sod.
That then was a clip from the 1988 film Buster, directed by David Green, written by Colin Schindler, and starring Phil Collins, Julie Walters, Larry Lamb, Martin Jarvis, Sheila Hancock, Stephanie Lawrence, Michael Atwell, Ralph Brown, and Anthony Quayle. It's billed as, I'm just reading this off the description here, a romantic crime comedy drama based on the events of the Great Train Robbery. The Great Train Robbery was a famous crime in British history that took place in August of 1963 that involved a gang robbing £2.61 million worth of currency off a train running on the West Coast Main Line from Glasgow to London. It had been a crime that had been very much, I mean, almost sanitised, really, that overlooked the fact that the real damage it did to some of the victims of it. But it was kind of almost like put across in the British media as like the cheeky chappies pulling off some degree of heist and lots of fun and stuff, kind of that whole stick it to the man kind of thing. And I'll come to some of the controversy around the movie a little bit later on in this story. But let's go back to 1987. The story of the movie that became Buster goes a little bit earlier, but just for the sake of 1987, that's when a man called Phil Collins got an offer through via his manager. Now, Phil Collins in 1987, a hugely successful recording artist, a string of hits both as a solo artist and also as part of the band Genesis, and I mean a very rich man, a very well rewarded man, and a very popular man for his music work. Now, in his earlier life, he had been doing some acting work. In fact, I mean, he turned up in the background of the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night, for instance, and he appeared in the West End as the Artful Dodger in a run of the musical Oliver. But it wasn't acting that really took off for Collins. Instead, it was his work as a musician. As such, by the time we get to the mid-1980s, he wasn't really the top of many people's casting lists for particular films. Yet, in the case of Buster, it turned out he very nearly was. That he got this offer through, would he be interested in taking on the lead role in a film based on the life of Buster Edwards, one of the great train robbers? And now Collins writes about this in his memoir, Not Dead Yet. And he talks about, as filmmakers saw it, Buster's story was a romance, that they weren't focusing heavily particularly on the crime itself. It was the romance. And he said throughout his petty life, his life of petty crime and the accompanying jail time, wrote Collins, he and his wife June were inseparable. And the filmmakers, as Collins told it, wanted to tell the couple's story with the great train robbery simply as background. Now, this may have been an early way just to try and put aside some of the controversy that would ultimately dog the picture, a very successful picture in the UK anyway. But Collins was, in the end, very interested as well. I mean, he'd done that early bit of acting. He turned up in the TV show Miami Vice as well. And he was looking for a bit of a creative challenge as well. Now, by the time we get to 1987, the film Buster already had a director on board, a man by the name of David Green. And David Green happened to be watching an episode of Miami Vice that Phil Collins turned up on. And his wife turned to him and said, there you go. That is your Buster Edwards. And so Green got in touch with Collins's manager, a man by the name of Tony Smith. And there's a very extensive behind the scenes making of, an hour long making of on YouTube of the film Buster as well. And the script made it to Collins's front door. In fact, Tony Smith read it first and said, I really like this. It's worth having a look. And Collins talks in that behind the scenes YouTube, the YouTube video there, of how most of the script, I mean, he was getting scripts. It was not massively unusual for him to get a script for a piece of drama or something like that. But generally, he'd read it, get a little bit bored, wouldn't make his way to the end of it. In this particular case, he kept reading. Now, this is very usual press junket fodder. No one says of a film that they've made that they picked up the script and it was terrible. But in this case, Collins saw something in it, read it pretty much in one go and was interested. Now, by 1987 as well, the person playing his co-star in the movie was already on board. In fact, she was on board first. It was Julie Walters. And so Collins would have to meet Julie Walters. And when he met her, he'd had a prosthetic nose fitted that would be part of his makeup for the film. That was at least the original plan. And the pair of them hit it off pretty quickly as well. Now, there was a little bit of backstory here, because David Green had previously made his feature directorial debut after an extensive television work on a film called Car Trouble in 1986. Car Trouble starred Julie Walters. It also had Colin Schindler involved in it as well. And she would talk about how she'd actually got the script for Buster at the Oscars in 1984. Now, Walters was up for a Best Actress Oscar for her lead role in Educating Rita, a terrific piece of acting work and a real underdog story that she made it to the Oscar nominees list as well. And off the back of that, she was given, again, a lot of scripts that she made her way through, but most of them very, very easily dismissible. In this case, she saw something in it as well. And what she liked was that Colin Schindler had written the screenplay, again, going back to what drew Collins in, less emphasis on the robbery and more very much on the aftermath of it and the impact of the couple, Buster and June, this married couple who clearly loved each other an awful lot, and their new life as they ultimately had to flee the UK and set up overseas. Now, the idea was that they would shoot the film around the UK. They had quite a few independent film companies and certainly lots of distributors around the world just to bring the budget together required to make this. The budget, I don't have a final figure for it, but very, very modest. And also in the 1980s, trying to get independent British films going was a lot easier said than done. In the end, it was a pair of production companies, the Movie Group and Vestron Pictures, who backed the film, but that notwithstanding, again, getting it distributed around the world will prove to be something of a challenge. I do want to note that this is one of the earliest films that was scored by the brilliant Anne Dudley as well, so I'm going to briefly name check her at this point. So, Phil Collins first got linked to it while he was on tour with Genesis, and pre-production began in earnest on the film in 1987. Now, the idea there was that they would shoot primarily in and around London, but there were challenges that they were going to come up during that, which I'll come to shortly. However, ahead of filming, there was the question of, do you want to meet the people who this is actually based on? Because it turned out Colin Schindler had written his script without meeting Buster Edwards, without meeting June either. And so, whilst to a degree that helped with preparation, that it was they weren't having to mimic actual people who they'd met, who the script had been based on, there was still the question coming up, do you actually meet them? The producers weren't massively keen on the idea. The film, I should point out, produced by Norma Heyman. Norma Heyman is the mother of David Heyman, who went on to produce all of the Harry Potter films as well. But in the case of Buster, this was her third feature. She'd done a 1987 gang warfare British movie by the name of Empire State. And in 1983, she produced The Honorary Consul, starring Michael Caine, Richard Gere, and also Bob Hoskins. Now, Bob Hoskins was an original choice for the role of Buster Edwards in Buster. It wasn't Phil Collins at the absolute top of the list. But the problem they came up against when they looked at the casting of the role was that Hoskins had done The Long Good Friday by this point, and he kind of nailed his gangsterish role on screen, the Cockney gangster figure. And would Buster just inevitably be compared to that if Hoskins was also taking on the lead role in this film as well? And that's why in the end they decided to take their casting ideas elsewhere. In the end, both Phil Collins and Julie Walters met the people they were actually playing ahead of the shooting of the film. That Collins would meet Buster Edwards firstly at a Genesis concert. And as he, again, let's go back to his memoir. He said, the producers didn't want me to meet Buster before filming, lest I become confused in my portrayal. The script is, after all, a bit of a fairy tale come sitcom telling of his life, wrote Phil Collins. However, he said, I do, however, briefly encounter him before we start at the pre-shoot soiree where the cast and crew get to know each other. Now, Julie Walters also wrote about this in her own memoir as well. And Collins said that the kind of lack of familiarity does mean there are a couple of key missteps in the film. I play him as a keen smoker, as it seemed everybody smoked in the 60s, plus it gives me something to do with my hands when we're filming. But I discover that Buster was the only one not smoking in the 1960s, and much worse, there's a scene in Mexico where I smack June, stroke Julie Walters, and when he sees this, Buster is appalled and says, I'd never do that to my June, he says to me, rightly offended. Now, Julie Walters talked of the early rehearsal work that they were doing, that the cast came together in September 1987 just to do a bit of preparatory work. But it was a couple of days into those rehearsals that she discovered she was pregnant. Now, this would have an impact on some reshoots, which I'll come to just in a moment. But filming went ahead October the 5th, 1987. The money had been secured and the plan, I mean, it's really quite ambitious, really, for a British indie of the 1980s, that it was going to film on two continents for a start, that the film went from Leicestershire to London and then to Mexico as well. Now, Collins slipped into the acting side of it really quite easily. I mean, he played the Artful Dodger on stage. And as he wrote, he said, "I must confess that I find the part of Buster Edwards easy to play." And he says, "I suppose he's an extension of the Artful Dodger, a Cockney wide boy. But there are tempests off screen," he noted. Now, the real Buster Edwards would get a cameo in the film. And he was slightly involved with it. He wasn't entirely distant. And Collins would talk about how the actual process of making a film, he'd been warned ahead of time he was likely to find it quite boring. Lots of filmmakers tell me this, that the actual making of a film, the day-to-day of it, is quite dull to watch, that you are spending 7, 8, 9 more, upwards of that hours, basically getting 2 to 3 minutes of film in the can if you're doing particularly well, and it goes at something of a snail's pace. Now, obviously, independent films tend to move a lot quicker than that, but still, in this case, it was not going to be an incredibly fast process, yet Collins admitted he found it fascinating. He'd not been in this environment before. He would go on to have a cameo in Steven Spielberg's film Hook, where he would get to see this on a much grander scale. I think he was in a film called Frauds as well, an Australian movie that followed a little bit down the line. But this was his first big experience, and he was the leading man in the movie, and he would just sit and watch them going about making the film, absorbing it, learning it, picking up new things. David Green, meanwhile, I mean, he had a very clear idea of how he wanted to shoot the film. In fact, he was adopting a Steadicam, a lot less common then than it was now, certainly for the character work that he was looking to put on the screen as well. And, I mean, production was going relatively okay. I mean, he was going to have a 3-month shoot, but there was a bit of a mishap in the midst of it all. Because 1987, towards the back end of 1987, there was a very famous storm that took place in the UK. It was one that the BBC Weather Service said that you had nothing to worry about. In fact, if you watch Gurinder Chadha's brilliant film Blinded by the Light, the same storm is referenced in that film as well. But whereas it's a kind of historical touch point of sorts, really, in Blinded by the Light, it was actually happening as they were trying to shoot Buster. Now, Buster is a film not set in the 1980s, obviously, so it's a bit of a modern period piece, that a lot of it was 1960s set. And they were trying to shoot it around London, but there was a lot of damage done by that particular storm at that particular time, and they battled on and they captured the footage as best that they could. But it did require, when they took it all to the edit room, that it was identified there were problems here and they were going to have to do some pickup work. So the editing was done by Leslie Walker. I should note the film was shot by Tony Immy. But I mean, in the case of Buster, when it came to the reshoots, I mean, by that point, Julie Walters was 7 months pregnant. The reshoots took place in just before Easter of 1988. And so they would have to use a fair amount of techniques just to hide the baby bum. I talked in the last but one episode of this podcast of the film Dangerous Minds was being shot around Michelle Pfeiffer's pregnancy. It was the same kind of thing there, really. There was a moment where they shot a Mexican hospital scene, but that wasn't shot on location in Mexico. That was shot in England. And this was in the winter of 1987. They shot that particular moment. Now, a lot of the location work they've been doing have been incredibly chilly. The British weather in the winter doesn't tend to be particularly nice. And so for the Mexican hospital scene, they had to pretend they were basically in 85 degree heat. And that took a little bit of an acting challenge. That notwithstanding, Buster was wrapped up and in the can January the 13th, 1988, with just that little bit of reshoot work needing to be done. And so then it became time to, well, put the movie together for its release, not least the music, because the producers, I mean, savvy enough, wanted Phil Collins to record the title song. This was very wise. If they got a hit title song, then Buster would get a name check each time it was played. If they could get it on the TV show Top of the Pops, even better, they might get the video showing, and that's basically showing the trailer for the film each time. But Collins initially refused. He didn't want to cross the streams. He wanted to separate off his music from his acting work. And so he suggested some alternatives instead. And in particular, a man called Lamont Dozier, a Motown legend who agreed to come in and write some of the songs. And so he wrote the music to a couple of songs. Two Hearts is one of them. Loco in Acapulco was another one. And then once he got hold of the music, Collins wrote the lyrics to both overnight. Fairly snappy that he put those together, performed them. But at that point, it was pointed out to him, what's your lyrics? You've really got to sing this. And so eventually he would contribute several songs to the soundtrack album, which would indelibly become linked to the film and have the effect that the producers were looking for. The film premiere was set to be attended by Prince Charles and Princess Diana, but already at this stage, there was a little bit of a tabloid storm that was building up over the fact that they'd made a film of this crime. A particular critic of the movie was a Conservative MP by the name of Ivor Stanbrook, who objected to the idea that the royal family should be coming along to a premiere of a film that he said, quote, commemorates a particularly sordid and vicious crime. Now, Ivor Stanbrook wasn't alone in his view, and it stirred up a lot of controversy, the fact that the movie had been made based on this, particularly given that the state that the actual victims of the crime had been left in. And so what I want to play you a little bit of Barry Norman's film programme, where he devoted a 10-minute segment of Film 88, as it was then, to the film Buster. And I mean, it's quite interesting what he did, because it was very clear that Barry Norman was not a fan of how they glamorised this at all, as you'll hear from the clip I'm just going to play you of his work in a minute. For those who don't know Barry Norman, very influential British critic who had a regular show on the BBC here in the UK. I grew up watching Barry Norman's film programme. And so what he did on this particular show is he got the real Buster Edwards and he got the police detective basically in conversation with each other to see if Buster Edwards had regrets, and trying to put both sides of the story over a little bit, but also trying to get across the fact that as much as you're playing this as kind of a cheeky chappy kind of film, there was a real life impactful crime at the heart of it. So Barry Norman's summation of the film at the end of this segment is just what I'm going to play you now, and it was not an uncommon response to the film. Have a listen to this.
And in a sense it is a love story, but a highly selective one, which ignores all the other colours of the spectrum and dips its brush only in the whitewash. It doesn't exactly glorify crime, but it certainly romanticises it. There are moments when you get the impression that, were it not for their trifling oversight in omitting to distribute their ill-gotten gains among the deserving poor, the train robbers were just like Robin Hood and his merry men, and Buster and June emerge ever so sweet and touching, only a pair of tarnished innocents, really. But fair dues, though the film itself may be amoral and even deplorable in its neglect of the act of violence, the performances are very good. In particular, Phil Collins and Julie Walters are so good that with a better script, they might have made you wonder what all the fuss was about. As it is, I think the fuss was really justified. Buster Edwards has served his time and is now earning an honest living. He may even be as likeable as the film suggests, but he's not a hero and never was one, and he shouldn't be portrayed as one.
Now, that was one of the more measured bits of the blowback against the film, but with the tabloids really gunning for it, it was looking very, very difficult for Charles and Diana to attend a royal premiere of the film. And as Collins wrote in his book, the tabloid press kick in. During the great train robbery, one of the gang coshed the train driver, Jack Mills. He died 7 years later, but people said he was never the same after the robbery, said Collins. The newspaper run stories along the lines of royal film glorifies violence, and suddenly there's an embarrassed back peddling. And Collins talks about how he rang Prince Charles up, now King Charles here in the UK, and basically Charles apologised and said we just can't come along to this anymore, even though he sort of wanted to. The critical response to it wasn't a million miles away from what Barry Norman was talking about there. That, I mean, in fact, the film itself comes out of it really quite well. And you know, rightly so as well. It's a well-made film, and it's played in a really charming way. And Julie Walters is great, and you know, Phil Collins is really good in the film as well. It's just that kind of underlying thing: should this be a film with this tone to it, based on this particular crime? And it was kind of, because it was such a tabloid football, what that also meant was it was getting headlines, and awareness of the movie was a at an unusually high amount, certainly for a British film production. For a British film indie to have this much tabloid red ink at that point was pretty much unheard of. And so Buster headed into UK cinemas and turned into a really, really big hit. It was the biggest independent movie at the UK box office in that particular year. It came out in, I mean, the premiere in the end was the 15th of September 1988. Its broader release that was the 16th of September 1988 initially in London, and then it spread further afield. And the box office numbers, certainly by the, certainly in comparison to A, British films, and B, British independent films, well, going to Definition magazines, it talked about how it made £66,000 in its opening weekend, and after going nationwide in its fifth week of release, it reached number one at the box office, grossing in the end £3.9 million in the UK, making it the, not just the highest grossing British independent film, but the highest grossing independent film of 1988 in the UK. This had also returned a very, very successful soundtrack album as well, which took three songs from the movie, and that would go on to, I mean, that received an Oscar nomination, the song Two Hearts. And so Buster is an Oscar nominated film. It won a Grammy for the best song written specifically for a motion picture or television. It won the Golden Globe the Golden Globes, nonsense, for best original song as well, in a tie with the song Let the River Run from Working Girl by Carly Simon. And the soundtrack album also took home a Brit Award as well. So this was a very well rewarded musical success, but also the film was really successful as well. Where it wasn't successful was in the US, because the distribution of Buster was lots of different distributors around the world. And I mean, it was just sold very, very, very badly. In fact, when Collins was collecting one particular award, I think it was the Golden Globes, actually, he went on stage and said, "This is fantastic for me. This is actually from a British movie called Buster that sank without a trace," which it pretty much did in America. I mean, less than half. I think it was just over $500,000, but negligible in terms of US box office. That notwithstanding, for a British indie to get take home a big profit and an Oscar nomination, very, very rare in this particular era. And the film would sell particularly well on video as well. And for Collins, it would launch, I mean, it really would launch a film career. He would stay in touch with Buster Edwards up until his suicide many, many years later as well. And he talk about how how Buster and June became firm friends of Phil Collins, and how they kept meeting up for many years after the movie was initially released. Would it kickstart a huge film career for Phil Collins? The answer to that, as you probably know, is no. But in 1991, he did do Spielberg's Hook. Then in 1993, he took the lead in Frauds, and he took on a good role in And the Band Played On as well. A really groundbreaking piece of work there. However, his next biggest contribution to movies was probably the contribution to the songs to the 1999 Disney movie Tarzan. After that, though, in terms of lead roles, that was pretty much all you were getting. Maybe all the noise around Buster was about as much hassle as he needed. But in all the time I've been doing this podcast, there aren't many stories of an independent movie success in the 1980s. And Buster, for better or worse, is very much one of them. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, I am on Twitter at Simon Brew. I'm on Blue Sky, also at Simon Brew. The entire Film Stories project is available on both of those platforms at Film Stories as well. We're at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We're at Instagram, Film Stories Magazine UK. We have a website. Oh, YouTube. Must tell you about YouTube. YouTube.com/filmstories. Have been recording some video Film Stories, which I'll be putting live shortly once we've sorted the internet of those out. If you go to filmstories.co.uk, that is a clickbait-free entertainment website. Imagine that in this era, a clickbait-free entertainment website, filmstories.co.uk, updated every weekday. It's got long-form features on it as well, all the stuff that's not supposed to work in the current era, and damn it, we're still going. Store.filmstories.co.uk is where you can buy all of our print magazines and also our UK-exclusive Blu-rays of No Way Out and Bull Durham. Sadly, our Blu-ray of Sneakers is now 100% sold out. Thank you for everyone who bought a copy of that. And the Patreon, again, is patreon.com/SimonBrew. But that really is it for this particular episode of Film Stories. There's a lot more coming up, which I'll tell you about in the coming weeks. Until then, you all take care. You all look after yourselves. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Take care all. Bye-bye.